I really think he wants to do something and bring that country into the real world. I think that we're going to have a success. I think this will be a very big success.
President Trump tweets the date and the location of his summit with North Korea's leader. It's Friday, May 11th, and this is VOA Asia. I'm David Byrd in Washington. Remember, you're a part of our program. Join us on VOA Asia Facebook. Also ahead, Malaysia swears in its new prime minister. Pakistani diplomats face travel restrictions in the U.S., and we meet a woman who turned her hobby into a lucrative business. That's all on today's VOA Asia. U.S. President Donald Trump has announced that his summit with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un will take place in Singapore on June 12th. In a tweet, Mr. Trump said, "We will both try to make it a very special moment for world peace." That came just hours after he personally welcomed home three Americans freed by North Korea. My colleague Sarah Williams spoke with VOA White House correspondent Steve Herman about the announcement and the release of the three U.S. citizens who had been detained by North Korea.
Both the United States and North Korea, which do not have diplomatic relations with each other, do have embassies in Singapore. It has the type of infrastructure, logistics, and communications to be able to handle high-level talks like this, along with the thousands of journalists that will also come along. And perhaps most importantly, it does appear to be within range of the plane that Kim Jong-un recently used to go from Pyongyang to Dalian, China. So he would be able to get in that aircraft from North Korea to Singapore without refueling.
Yeah, because I believe he and other members of his family are not exactly what you could say keen flyers.
Traditionally, North Korean leaders have traveled about by train in their own country and then on trips to China, and rarely have North Korean leaders ventured beyond the train tracks.
Well, now this announcement comes just after three Americans who were detained by North Korea have been released, and President Trump and First Lady Melania Trump welcomed them at Joint Base Andrews, and I believe you were there when they returned.
Well, it was an extraordinary scene because the president usually ends his evenings quite early, and he does go out, for example, to dinner at his nearby hotel. He usually seems to be back by about 10 p.m. So to see him and the First Lady, as well as the Vice President and the Second Lady, out at Andrews at 3 o'clock in the morning was something really remarkable. But perhaps the most encouraging aspect of that was that these three U.S. citizens were able to walk down the stairs from the plane with the president and first lady, who went on board briefly to talk to them, unaided. They appeared to be in very good shape, considering their ordeal. Obviously, a much better outcome than with Otto Warmbier, the University of Virginia student from Cincinnati, who essentially came back in a coma after his arrest in North Korea.
And I believe these three, they're undergoing medical evaluations at Walter Reed National Military Medical Center.
Correct. They were taken in a van directly to Walter Reed for evaluation and medical checkups. There were none of their family members at Andrews to greet them, and that's pretty much in keeping with protocol for Americans returning from long periods of imprisonment abroad. Authorities will also want to debrief them pretty much before they have contact with family members and friends.
That's VOA White House correspondent Steve Herman speaking with Sarah Williams. We invite you to read more on our top story by following us on Facebook at VOA Asia and the VOAnews.com website. These are among the top Asia stories trending on VOAnews.com. Trump says North Korea summit will be in Singapore June 12th. Analysts say speed of denuclearization emerging as key summit issue. Former Malaysian prime minister returns to power after stunning election win. 104-year-old Australian euthanasia advocate ends his life in Switzerland. And at Cambodia's last independent newspaper, top editor fired, foreign journalists quit. Expanded coverage of these stories and more is on Facebook at VOA Asia and on the voanews.com website. You're listening to VOA Asia. I'm David Byrd in Washington. Malaysia's former leader, Mahathir Mohamad, was sworn in Thursday as the country's seventh prime minister after his stunning election victory the day before, a feat that makes him the world's oldest elected leader.
Saya Mahathir bin Mohamad.
He said, I, Mahathir Mohamad, after my appointment as Prime Minister, swear to honestly carry out all my obligations with full dedication. I will be truly faithful to Malaysia and will preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution. The ceremony at the official state palace in Kuala Lumpur ended a day of doubt as rumors circulated that former Prime Minister Najib Razak's Barisan Nasional Coalition would try to maintain its grip on power. Clive Kessler is a professor emeritus at the University of New South Wales and a longtime Malaysia watcher. He told VOA's Victor Beatty that he was surprised by the election's outcome, despite a strong current against the government.
It seems that by the very strength of the determination to win this election, Najib and his government alienated a sufficient number of people to bring about his downfall.
How did he do that?
There was a great deal of discontent going back several years now over this one MDB matter, over the missing billions of state funds. But on top of that, the Election Commission in Malaysia has increasingly become partisan, and as Najib recognized that he had to get a victory, the Election Commission used enormous partisan creativity to create a situation in which most of the opposition and many non-Malay voters were locked up in what you call the United States electoral districts of up to 150,000, while the power base of Najib's government in the rural areas, in the Malay heartland, you tended to find most electoral districts were only a quarter or a fifth of that number. And this was a way of weighting the system in favor of the government. On top of that, Najib's government brought in measures against, borrowing from Trump's expression, fake news to stop people reporting on things, making criticisms of the government. Even when Dr. Mahathir came out as leader of this opposition, they refused to register his party to allow the opposition coalition and its campaign logo to be recognized. And in the end, they were cutting pictures of Dr. Mahathir out of posters because they said that the opposition had no right to show his face. I think in the end, this was just too much for most Malaysians to stomach.
I understand Mahathir's key to victory was the rural vote.
Yes, well, the key to all elections in Malaysia is the rural vote, particularly the Malay heartlands in peninsular Malaysia. Generally, that vote has been closely contested between UMNO and the Islamist opposition party PAS. Now, what happened this time that the UMNO vote collapsed rather in those rural areas? The vote went either to the Islamic Party, which made a bit of a comeback in its heartland areas in the east coast of the peninsula. But in the end, enough Malays were persuaded by Mahathir and by other people in the opposition to abandon UMNO and to vote for them. And that's what brought about the situation in which there were enough Malay votes in the Malay rural areas to give victory to the opposition and to take power away from Najib and his government.
That's Clive Kessler, a professor emeritus at the University of New South Wales in Australia, speaking with VOA's Victor Beatty. Happening in Asia, a court in Shanghai has sentenced the founder of the Chinese insurance company Anbang to 18 years in prison. Wu Xiaohe, the former chairman of Anbang, pleaded guilty to fraudulently raising billions of dollars from investors and diverting the money to his own use. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're happy you're with us on this Friday on VOA Asia. The United States government has imposed travel restrictions on Pakistani diplomats, holding them to within just a few kilometers of either their embassy here in Washington or their consulate offices around the country. Why exactly is this happening? Well, I'm talking with VOA Urdu reporter Aman Azhar, who had an exclusive interview with Pakistan's ambassador to the United States on Capitol Hill Thursday. Aman, thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me, David.
Run down for me real quick what these travel restrictions do and why are they being imposed?
Well, first of all, there's a background to it. The U.S. embassy staff in Pakistan have been having this complaint for a while now that they're facing some kinds of travel restriction back in Pakistan, and it's apparently been tolerated. It's nothing really happened back in the United States, but this time around, under the Trump administration, for the first time, we've seen that there's been a reciprocity, that the formal restriction have been imposed on the diplomatic staff from the Pakistan consulates and embassies here in the United States. So there was a lot of speculation in the air earlier on for the last 2 months or so. And finally today when I spoke with the ambassador, Azaz Chaudhry, he's an outgoing ambassador, he confirmed that yes, indeed, the Pakistan's diplomatic staff is now under travel restrictions, which kind of restrict them from moving beyond a certain limits from the embassy and the consulates. And if they want to proceed beyond that, they're going to have prior kind of a bureaucratic paperwork has to be done and put in so that they can move beyond that point. So now there's, according to Ambassador, this is not going to help in kind of forging the bilateral relation that both the countries are trying to do, which is on a downhill for a long time now.
And this also comes at a time when President Trump has announced that the United States will pull out of the Iran nuclear deal. Pakistan is a nuclear power, and they are an ally in the region. Why do you think the Trump administration, or why did the ambassador say the Trump administration would take steps like this?
Well, David, it has to go to Afghanistan, or the kind of a cooperation that the United States has been wanting Pakistan to extend. Now, cutting the long story short, the Trump administration is not happy with the way Pakistan has been delivering or not able to do exactly what the U.S. administration wants. This has been a long-term issue. Also, it goes before the present administration, but this is for the first time that the Trump administration has actually taken the steps which previous administrations have not really done. So this is like upping the ante in various ways. So this is like a message being sent to Pakistan that this time around there are different players in the office here in the United States and that they are willing to go beyond where previous administrations have not gone. So it has to do also with the kind of cooperation which the U.S. administration is trying to extract from Pakistan in terms of bringing some sort of stability in Afghanistan too.
Aman Azhar is a reporter with VOA's Urdu service. You can follow his coverage of this story by logging on to our website, voanews.com. Coming up, new victories in the fight against aging. You're listening to VOA Asia.
Hi, I'm Larry London, and I'm the host of Border Crossings, inviting you to join me for one of the best hours of request music possible on the radio. We've got all your favorite songs by your favorite singers. You tell us what to play. It's requests and dedications, and it happens every weekday right here on The Voice of America.
This news from VOA Asia, India's Foreign Minister Sushma Swaraj met with the President of Myanmar on Thursday in Naypyidaw to boost bilateral ties. Swaraj is on a two-day visit to its eastern neighboring country and will hold discussions with key leaders on issues including the Rohingya repatriation and to reinforce ties between the two countries. This is VOA Asia. We're glad you're with us on this Friday morning. I'm David Byrd in Washington. Losing your job can be devastating, but sometimes it can also be the birth of a new opportunity. Virginia Wallen thought her career was going one way, but when she lost her job, she turned her carpentry hobby into a business. As Faiza El-Masri tells us, the entrepreneur isn't just succeeding in her new career, she's tearing down stereotypes and building a new role model. Faith Lapidus narrates.
Virginia Wallen, who grew up helping out on her family's farm, developed all the skills required by a professional woodworker early on.
It wasn't so much as a passion growing up, you know, doing woodworking, as much as a requirement, you know, help me, you know, mend fences or you know, work on the farm or do things like that.
Still, carpentry wasn't her first career choice. Wallen worked for 11 years with an IT company.
I was pretty certain that that was my career path for the rest of my life. Like, I was going to retire from this company and this job. When I got laid off, I was devastated. I didn't quite know what to do with myself. I was applying for jobs everywhere. I cannot just sit around and do nothing. And I was driving my husband crazy.
Inspired by her dogs, Penny and Chloe, Wallen returned to her hobby and made a crate for them. Then she posted the pictures online.
That week, I had five people reach out to me asking if I would build them one.
So she came up with the idea saying, maybe I'll start building these. I thought she was crazy at first, but after the first one and was well received, it was great. You know, I was like, okay, well, if this is going to take off, this is going to take off.
And it did. But that wouldn't have been possible without her husband's help.
So I kind of took over Mr. Mom. I kind of stepped in and, you know, had to be more hands-on with the kids and more hands-on with the school stuff and dinners and stuff like that.
That gave Wallen the time she needed to build her brand, Ginny Bins. Her products are made of recycled wood and have a warm, vintage look. She markets her work online. And that's where Heather Abbott discovered Wallen, as she was in the process of opening a daycare center.
I want something very customized that looked like it would go into a home.
What about the pictures that we have, the art boards that you like so much?
Abbott says Wallen understood what she wanted, from the whimsical to the practical.
One of the things that I really was looking forward to is there's a bookshelf that looks like a tree. And the table for the staff kitchen, because I wanted them to have a nice place. And the angle of the room was weird, so she had to make it small enough to fit in.
Abbott loves each of these items and the message of unlimited possibilities behind them.
That teaches our teachers, our students, our families that pass by through. They know that Virginia made those pieces, and they can say, this is a stereotype that we're breaking down.
For Virginia Wallen, that's woodworking, the work she has fun doing every day. For writer Faiza El-Masri, I'm Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
This news from VOA Asia. Hong Kong's richest man, Lee Ka-shing, held his last meeting with shareholders Thursday and then handed his eldest son the keys to a $35 billion empire. Lee is stepping aside from a conglomerate that employs thousands of people and has assets in more than 50 countries. All the big stories come your way throughout the day on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. No matter where they live, whether it be in the Middle East or in the rainforests of Bangladesh, young people are capable of coming up with fresh ideas about how to improve life in their communities. At a recently held exhibition in the sprawling Zaatari refugee camp in northern Jordan, Syrian teenagers showcased inventions geared towards making refugee camps more livable. VOA's George Putich has more.
Life in a refugee camp is hard, with all kinds of shortages, from food and water to energy and transport. Humanitarian organizations do what they can, but resources are often limited. UNICEF, partnered with the One Foundation, organizes workshops to teach young people various skills and to promote entrepreneurship. UNICEF innovation specialist Robin Louis says they encourage students to look around, identify problems, come up with solutions, and maybe turn them into marketable products.
So, for example, they go into the community and they say, well, there's not enough lighting. They come back to the lab, work with the facilitators, build the lights, go back to the community, test the lights with the community. They'll give them feedback. and then improve it.
That is how 15-year-old refugee Dina Askar designed a simple and affordable battery lamp.
There is no electricity between 5 p.m. until 3 a.m., but students need light to study, and with many newborns, mothers need light to take care of their babies. The costs of this invention are very cheap.
Sawan Harb, who uses a wheelchair, redesigned a two-wheeled electric bike to improve his mobility. He shared the challenges of his project with visitors.
I asked for help from someone who works in blacksmithing, and I explained to him the new design with three wheels to be able to climb on it from a wheelchair.
UNICEF representative Robert Jenkins says this is just the start of a process they hope to expand to other refugee camps in Jordan.
We think there's enormous potential to scale up, and absolutely we are in need of additional funding in order to realize its full potential, which would be scaling up across the kingdom. So youth in all communities would have an opportunity to go through this process and in the end realize their innovative ideas.
For the less tech-savvy in the camp, workshops also covered sewing and decorative crafts. George Putich, VOA News.
The Spanish explorer Ponce de Leon never found the Fountain of Youth, a magical water source that supposedly is capable of reversing the aging process. But scientists at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota, are working to extend the human lifespan and delay the onset of multiple age-related diseases and disabilities. VOA's Maya Kay tells us how.
Old age typically brings with it health problems, chronic diseases, frailty, and loss of independence. As the world population ages, the aging process poses a challenge for healthcare systems in many countries, according to Tamara Chonia, one of the lead scientists at Mayo Clinic's Robert and Arlene Cogut Center on Aging.
In the United States, for instance, 80% of healthcare cost is basically related to age-related diseases. And aging is the highest risk factor of a lot of diseases and comorbidities.
But Mayo Clinic scientists believe it may be possible to delay age-related diseases by modulating fundamental aging mechanisms. Experiments are underway with mice.
So the view in the aging field is why not go for a root cause, which is fundamental aging processes themselves, to try to delay the onset of these disorders as a group and to increase what we call health span, the period during life when people are independent, free of pain, free of disability, and enjoy life. So the view of the field recently has been, how do we add life to years, not necessarily years to life?
It was at Mayo's Center on Aging where senolytic drugs were discovered. Agents that selectively eliminate senescent cells that are responsible for aging processes without damaging healthy ones. Basically, these drugs have a potential to slow aging by killing bad cells which accumulate with aging and cause a range of age and disease-related problems. Human studies are next. Senolytic drugs will be given to people with illnesses directly related to the aging process.
We're finding that different combinations of these drugs are effective in different situations. So there's a lot of work to be done in figuring out what the right combinations of these drugs will be for particular human conditions.
If senolytic drugs manage to reduce the health impact of aging and have minimal side effects, then scientists plan to gradually move from treating the consequences of aging to preventing it altogether.
But there is a hope, maybe, we can get positive results. And if it's true, it might revolutionize medicine. It would be transformative.
Until then, several additional studies need to be done to determine the safety and efficacy of these drugs. But so far, the results look promising. Maya Kay for VOA News, Rochester, Minnesota.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. Now, you can get our program on iTunes and SoundCloud. You can download our podcast and take VOA Asia with you. Find us at voanews.com. Be sure to let us hear from you. Visit VOA Asia Facebook, or you can email us, voaasia@voanews.com. Thanks for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Keith Holmes. I'm David Byrd in Washington. Enjoy the day.